Brazil challenges Cuba, the future of autonomous cars, and a true battle of the bands. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Brazil is paying Cuba to use their doctors, but that may change. We'll learn more about what Brazil's new president is threatening. Also, if you drive in parts of Miami, you may have seen these Ford vehicles that say self-driving cars. It's part of a project to improve the technology. What are they learning from using these cars in Miami? And when will these become part of our lives? Also, Electric Kiff is a band that experiments in jazz and rock, and they mix it into something they call post-nuclear rock. Today, we have another live from the 305. Finally, we'll tell you about a music competition in South Florida that's all about flexing your talents. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Brazil's president-elect Jair Bolsonaro is going after Cuba, more specifically, their doctors. Cuba sends tens of thousands of doctors around the world to help fill shortages, but the Cuban government also takes a large portion of their earnings. Bolsonaro is confronting the Cuban government about how it treats those doctors, who also are not allowed to bring their families with them. In response, Cuba says it's pulling its doctors out of Brazil. Well, joining us now is WLRN's America's correspondent, Tim Padgett. Tim, always a pleasure.
As it is for me.
Thank you so much. Let's start by understanding how Cuba sends its doctors around the world. How many and where do they go?
You've got about an estimated 50,000 Cuban doctors who are essentially exported all around the world to about 60 developing countries. And they're there mainly to help those developing countries, as you mentioned, fill acute doctor shortages. Countries like Brazil, a lot of countries in Africa, for example, they just don't have enough doctors to serve their populations, whereas Cuba has a surplus of doctors because of its medical system, which is it has always taken great pride in. And so it sends these doctors out, and it makes a boatload of money doing it.
Is it hundreds of millions, billions of dollars?
It is billions of dollars. This year, Cuba is estimated to rake in about $13 billion from the services, the medical services that these doctors provide around the world.
And so Brazil, as you said, relies heavily on Cuban doctors.
Well, there just aren't enough Brazilian doctors being educated in medical schools. And a big reason for that is that there are really no sort of loan or aid programs for medical school in Brazil. So who ends up going to medical school? Just the kids from affluent families. And so as a result, you have fewer than two doctors in Brazil per each 1,000 people. Whereas in Cuba, you have more than six doctors per 1,000 people. So do the math. Cuba's got the doctors to spare. Brazil needs them.
And we're talking about like just, you know, family care or specialists or
all kinds, mostly GP, because you're talking about shortages in poor rural towns and urban slums, the infamous favelas, for example, of Brazil. That's where they usually get sent. Because, for example, what's exacerbating that doctor situation in Brazil is not only do you have not enough doctors, the doctors you do have generally refuse to work outside of large cities. In the northern state of Pernambuco, for example, in the capital city of Recife, that's where about three-fourths of the doctors reside, but yet Recife has only less than a fifth of the state's population. So there's a real alarming gap there that, you know, bottom line, whether you agree with the program or not, the Cuban doctors help fill.
So what sparked this outrage for Bolsonaro? Why is he making this an issue right now?
Well, there's always been a controversy, not just in Brazil, but around the world about this Cuban doctors program. And 5 years ago, Brazil, under its more leftist Workers' Party, let's remember that Jair Bolsonaro is a much more right-wing politician. Under the left-wing Workers' Party presidency 5 years ago, they started a program called Mais Médicos, or More Doctors. And half of the doctors in that program, which essentially brings in foreign doctors to fill that doctor shortage in Brazil, more than half of them are Cuban doctors. And there's always been a big controversy about this program because, as you pointed out at the beginning, the Cuban doctors do not get all of the money that they're paid. They're lucky to see 10-20% of what these governments pay for these each doctor's services. And that's why Bolsonaro is essentially calling this slave labor. The other big issue is that they're not allowed, as you pointed out, to bring their families with them. And critics charge the Cuban government with using that as leverage. So if a Cuban doctor on one of these programs abroad decides to defect, for example, he is not allowed to return to Cuba for 8 years, meaning he can't see his family for 8 years. So there's a lot of criticism about that as well.
And so, I mean, basically, is Bolsonaro just offering like a sort of asylum? Because he's saying you could bring your families.
Well, sure. Bolsonaro is essentially giving the Cuban government an ultimatum. If you want to keep sending your doctors here to Brazil, they've got to be able to keep everything we pay them. It can't just go straight, you know, 80% of it just can't go straight to the communist Cuban government's coffers. And two, you have to allow them to bring their families here. And the Cuban government hasn't taken that very well.
And yeah, because I wondered their response, because even though they're holding the families as that leverage, well, the doctors, that's a lot of money for the Cuban government.
It's, as we said, $13 billion. That's more than what Cuba earns from tourism, mining, and remittances abroad from Cubans abroad in communities, exile communities like Miami, all of that combined. So this is Cuba's main revenue export source.
So which side do you think bends most on this one?
That's going to be interesting, because Brazil really needs these doctors. I mean, one of the silver linings of this, no matter what Bolsonaro's real motivations were, one of the silver linings is that you could finally see Brazil get forced to confront its doctor shortage situation, come up with a Brazilian solution to this problem instead of relying so heavily on foreign doctors to fill the shortage. One way, for example, that they're talking about doing that is telling states that they'll pay for a doctor's medical education if that doctor then spends his or her first 2 or 3 years as a doctor in those rural areas or those urban slums where doctors are needed. That's one possible solution.
Again, talking with WLRN's America's correspondent, Tim Padgett, a fight between Cuba and Brazil over medicine. Cuba exports tens of thousands of doctors to different countries, and as we heard, many of them go to Brazil. And Brazil now basically saying, you know what, we don't like the way you do business, and we're going to stop using those doctors. But then where do they get those doctors?
And where does Cuba get them? Let's keep in mind, Cuba stands to lose about $300 million a year if they pull all those 8,300 doctors out of Brazil.
This is going to be a fascinating fight. Just out of curiosity, what is the Cuban community here in South Florida said about this?
Well, the Cuban community here, as you well know, is very much against, a strong, strident critic of the Cuban government, the communist government there, and they're applauding, they're cheering Bolsonaro quite heartily about this, because they feel it's about time one of these developing countries confronted Cuba about this, quote, slave labor situation with the Cuban doctors.
When did the issue with the shortage of doctors start in Brazil? I mean, when did it start to steamroll to the point where it is now?
It's been longstanding, and it really started to steamroll about a decade ago when they really started realizing that there just weren't any doctors out. I mean, it's one of the reasons that the Leftist Workers' Party came to power about 20 years ago was because of social problems like this. And they've tried everything. They've tried offering doctors, you know, lavish salaries to go out to poor rural towns to work for a few years. None of them have taken the offer.
You're also working on another piece for next week's LATAM report. It's about a U.S. Navy hospital ship that's helping Venezuelan refugees. Tell us about that.
Well, what's interesting here is that the U.S. Naval hospital ship known as Comfort is making a mission now. Right now, this week, it's in the port of Riohacha, Colombia, and one of its big missions is to help Venezuelan refugees who have come into Colombia and other countries in South America to get the medical treatment that they couldn't get back in Venezuela because the medical and food shortages, for example, are just so acute. And one of the interesting things here is that you're seeing a lot of Venezuelan American doctors from here in South Florida volunteered to work on that ship. So a lot of them came to the United States because they couldn't do their work anymore in Venezuela. There simply weren't any more medical supplies, no more medicines. They felt helpless. They came to the United States to practice their profession. Now they say they finally get a chance on this hospital ship to treat Venezuelans again the way they wish they could have treated them back in Venezuela.
And that is the LATAM report that's coming up next Tuesday.
Next Tuesday, right.
Tim, as always, such a pleasure, man. I really appreciate it.
As for me. Thanks, Lewis.
And again, he is WLRN's America's correspondent, Tim Padgett. Just a quick note, today we were going to bring you a conversation with reporters from the Miami Herald about the in-depth series called Perversion of Justice. The head reporter is Julie Brown. It's a powerful and disturbing look at a Palm Beach millionaire who was accused of running a sex trafficking ring of minors, and he found a way to avoid a life sentence in prison and is free today. We're going to get that series next week, but if you can, go to the Miami Herald and read it. It is absolutely powerful and eye-opening. All right, well, don't go anywhere, because coming up in less than 20 minutes, we're going to go back to live from the 305, a mix of jazz and rock. You're hearing it right now. But still to come, we're going to have, when are we going to have self-driving cars? Did you know that there are some already on the streets of Miami? Yeah, we'll talk about that coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, if you drive around Miami, you've probably seen the Ford cars that say self-driving test vehicle. It's the vehicle with a big white box on the roof that allows it to see everything. Well, Ford picked Miami as part of a project to test these AVs for commercial use, delivering pizza for Domino's here in Miami. What have they learned? What will these cars become part of our everyday life? And better question, when am I going to get one of those? Well, joining us now is head of business for autonomous vehicles at Ford, Brian Wolf. He's joining us from the studios of WDET in Detroit. Brian, it's such a pleasure, man. Thanks so much.
Hey, thanks, Lewis. Thanks for having me.
Why did Ford choose Miami of all places?
Well, there's a couple factors that go into that. First, you know, we want to operate in an urban dense environment. And that's because, unlike today's traditional retail model, we plan to own these vehicles. And these fleet of vehicles will be available to consumers and businesses to do their transportation needs. And so we want to make sure they're operating where there's lots of demand for them. So that narrows it down, you know, to the top cities in the U.S. Secondly, the technology is, you know, still in its early days, and so weather's a challenge for it. And so that means that we need to be in places where there's not much snow and heavy weather. And so Miami was a good place for that. And then finally, we were looking for an area and a city that we thought would really adopt the technology and where the government was willing to work with us. And, you know, the officials in Miami welcomed us with open arms. We worked very collaboratively with them to put the technology on the road. And so far, it's been a great relationship.
I've seen a few of them actually right around the neighborhood here for the radio station. How many vehicles do you have in Miami right now?
We have a handful of vehicles right now, and we plan to ramp that up as we get closer to 2021. So 2021 is when we officially plan to launch our service. So between now and then, we'll continue to add more and more vehicles to the fleet to allow us to develop the technology.
Yeah, and how often? I mean, how often are they driving around? What's the routine?
They drive around pretty much all day, and we have a couple shifts of drivers. There's two people who are behind the wheel at all times, one in the driver's seat and one in the passenger seat. And they're going out, and they're testing the new software that's on the vehicles, making sure that it can handle the different situations that the vehicles may face in Miami. And so, you know, our goal is to get to 2021 as soon as possible. So we try and keep those vehicles running as much as possible.
Yeah, I mean, every time I see one, I'm always curious. I'm always peeking over and looking, seeing if that guy behind the wheel, is he driving or is that thing driving itself? And but I wonder too, also like the neighborhoods, because like I said, I've seen them around here in this downtown area near the Wynwood area. But have you been able to get to all the different neighborhoods in Miami-Dade?
Yeah, you know, we started off in the Wynwood area. That's actually where our main operations are. We have a terminal there where the vehicles are housed. And we start there, and we slowly, you know, as we learn the city and the vehicles get smarter, we begin to expand from there. So we're still, you know, operating a lot in that Wynwood area and slowly expanding out. But eventually you can plan to see these vehicles in a lot more square miles around the Miami area.
So it's interesting. You talk about Miami. Yes, we have very unique traffic challenges here, to say the least. I mean, a lot of construction and development. You've got the new drivers from Latin America. And the lack of dedicated, cyclist lanes and crosswalks for pedestrians. How have these cars dealt with some of these challenges up to this point? I mean, are you happy that, the technology is there to be able to handle so much?
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. One of our criteria was selecting a city that did have a complex driving environment. There are many ways to tackle this problem. You could design the technology to just simply go up and down a single street. But we really want to get these vehicles out at scale and in mass. And for us, that's finding complex environments. And so Miami provides a lot of that. And, we've hired some of the best engineers and brains in the world to solve this problem. And that's what's going to differentiate us in the end, is that we're going to be one of the handful of companies that can operate in an environment like Miami. So Miami was a perfect test ground. And, every day the technology faces new challenges, things that we didn't expect. And those are the things that then the engineers take back. They review that particular situation, and they try and come up with a new algorithm or a new way to approach that situation. And then once they do that, they run it through simulation, where we try and simulate that situation again. And then the vehicle goes back out on the road, and maybe we'll encounter it again, maybe we won't, but hopefully we do, and we get a chance to see how well the new software is working.
And would you be able to tell us a little bit about what some of those challenges are that you did not expect, and how you overcome that?
I think it's hard. I mean, I think you kind of anticipate that when you're in a city environment, you're going to face pedestrians and cyclists. But, there's certain things, like I think the mopeds have been more of a challenge than we expected. There's the construction zones that pop up all of a sudden, and there's different ways to deal with it. So, construction zones could be just us getting better data on where the construction zones are and being more aware of when they actually will show up. Things like mopeds, that's something that we've had to train the cars to deal with. So I think, situations continue to emerge. That's what makes this problem so challenging, is there's probably infinite situations. And it's a question of how do you begin to tick them all off your list and make sure that you have them all covered before you really launch the technology.
No, don't feel bad. We're all still trying to figure out how to work around the mopeds too. But you talked about, dealing with a government, wanting to be in a city that had a government that was open to it. What can you tell us about those conversations with the Miami-Dade County and the Miami City officials? What did you want to see from them that would convince you? And obviously they did convince you to come here.
We wanted to see a relationship where we felt that they were willing to embrace this technology, where they're willing to help us. Last week we were, or 2 weeks ago, we were in Miami, and we did a big media event down there, and you may have seen some of the press around it. And as part of that, we worked with the city to set up, AV parking areas so that the cars could pull in and media people could get into the vehicles. So we were looking for a relationship like that because, the technology has challenges outside the technology itself. There's no longer a driver in the vehicle. So how do you load the vehicle with that driver's not there to put the pizza in the vehicle? Or how do people make sure they get let off in a safe place? And those are the kinds of things and challenges that we want to work with the city. And so that's, one of the first things we do when we think about going to cities, go meet with those officials and talk to them about these things and some of the challenges we expect and make sure that they're willing to dedicate the time and resources to help us. And so far, Miami's been fantastic. It's been a great relationship, and we're very, very glad that we selected the city of Miami.
Now, you talked about, facing new challenges every day and then having to rework the software to adapt to those changes. But how can you tell us how the vehicles have been performing so far? And have they been in any accidents or any kind of, maybe little bumps with other cars or people?
So far, I was in the vehicle 2 weeks ago and was really impressed. And I think, you can read some of the media articles as well. It's pretty amazing. The driver in the front seat has his hands very close to the wheel at all times, just to make sure that in case the vehicle does run into a situation where it's unfamiliar, the driver can interject. But in general, the vehicle is driving around with very few interjections, if any. And it's amazing. It's amazing to see, all of a sudden a cyclist get on the road and how the car slows down. It feels very natural too. That's one of the hard things in dealing with technology is how do you make sure the car drives naturally? It's not, it's not herky jerky when it brakes and it accelerates. And so I was very impressed. That being said, you know, we still have work to do, and 2021 is our launch date, and so there's still a lot to be done, but overall very impressed with what the team's accomplished.
I'm talking with Brian Wolf. He's head of business for Ford's autonomous vehicle fleet. The company is testing these driverless cars in the city of Miami, and you've probably seen them. They are the Ford cars that you see drive around. It says self-driving test car on it, and it's got that big box on the roof, which is basically seeing everything all the time. He's joining us from the studios of WDET in Detroit. So, Brian, I wanted to come back and talk a little bit more about the data that you are collecting. And I think about what, you know, that box I keep talking about up on the roof. I mean, is that basically all that you're using for the car to figure out what's going on around it? But I want to get a sense of the data you're collecting and how you're utilizing that data, you know, to, again, improve the system.
Yeah, so we have different sensors on the vehicle. So there are cameras on the vehicle, there are radar on the vehicle, and there's a special sensor that some people may be familiar with. It's called LIDAR, and that's sort of a sensor that sends out lasers that then bring back a 3D image of what's going on around the car. And each of those sensors serves a different purpose, but and some, you know, each sensor has trade-offs. So, you know, cameras are great at getting clear images of what's going on around you immediately in the vicinity, but not very good at seeing what's far away. And so you use those sensors to then begin to bring all those signals in and put together a visual of what's going on around the car. And so we're gathering all that sensor data, you know, as the vehicle is driving. Because that's what the vehicle uses to make decisions. And so if it sees something, it's going to, you know, turn the wheel, or it's going to accelerate or decelerate or brake. And then two, you know, as we collect that data, we're looking for unique situations. So for example, we talked about those mopeds. So, you know, we try and make sure that we collect those situations so we can then bring them back to the engineers to go ahead and learn from the situation that they had anticipated. Yeah. And program the vehicle or change the algorithms. So those are really the two main things that we're trying to do with the data.
You know, I was looking at, it's interesting, life's going to change when we have self-driving cars, because you're no longer selling a car as an experience. Now it's just it's a transport, and people will be able to do a lot of other things in the car. Granted, you drive through Miami, you see people doing a lot of things while they're driving they shouldn't be, but I was looking at this study, and people, you know, they were looking at what people will do, and, you know, well, they'll eat more, they'll read more. You probably saw this too, this study that shows people will also start having sex in the car. I mean, is Ford considering the preferences and the activities, you know, all of the different things people might want to use an autonomous vehicle for?
Yeah, you know, we think about all the different, we call them use cases. So we think about all the use cases that the vehicle may have. And one of the things that we're doing is we're designing a purpose-built vehicle in 2021 for this technology. So the cars you see on the road today are prototype cars, and they're based on, you know, today's vehicles. But in 2021, we're going to launch a purpose-built car. And that car will have no steering wheel and no pedals, and will be very much designed to serve a lot of different use cases. And give people an experience that they may not have today, you know, when they're driving, because you have, you know, your hands and so forth. And
do you know what that would look like? Do you know what that car is going to look like yet?
I can't tell you what it's going to look like, but it will definitely be a different experience on the inside. And I think that people will be pretty excited about it.
Let me finish with this, because, you know, there are people who are obviously, I'm going to admit that I'm one of them. I'm excited about this idea because I just am so tired of driving. I'd love to just jump in and not think about it. But I think about also other generations. I think about my mom's generation. She's always telling me how terrified she is of this idea of a car that's driving itself. I also think about way back when elevators had an operator. And then when the operator was gone, we had to train an entire culture to not be afraid to get in an elevator and just go ahead and push a button. Do you think we're going to have to do like this whole cultural training of people to be able to get comfortable with just getting in a car and there's no wheel?
Yeah. Look, I mean, I think there's definitely going to be some education process involved. There's so many advantages to the technology in terms of opening mobility up to people, you know, especially the elderly. I think that people will see those advantages and want to embrace it. We will need to educate people on it, and we'll need to also make sure that when we design the car, people are comfortable with it, that they still have some control. So So the question is, you know, how do you put controls in the vehicle, stop buttons, things like that, that give people a sense that, yes, well, I'm not exactly driving, I still am in control. And that's something we think about a lot. And we've done a lot of studies on it, a lot of tests on it, and that's something we're going to incorporate into our vehicle in 2021.
And the other thing, too, is this, is affordability. You know, I think about the electric car and the Tesla as an example. It's a great idea, but it's kind of out of reach for a lot of people. Will, do you see autonomous cars as being something that people can afford, or we're not going to own cars, we're just going to borrow them or rent them for a time?
Yeah, I think initially, you know, the plan is that we're going to own the fleet and we're going to essentially provide transportation services to people. So you'll be able to hail the vehicle through an app, or, you know, Domino's can use it to deliver a pizza. And that's because that's one of the reasons for that is because the cars are so expensive. And so by utilizing the car across multiple people and businesses, you know, the cost of that vehicle is much lower on a person-by-person basis. So in a lot of ways, this will make transportation much more affordable, which we're excited about because I think it opens up mobility to a lot of people who may not have access to it today.
Well, I will admit that I am still looking forward to you guys get to work a little bit faster because I'd love me a driverless car. I'm looking forward to that day. Brian Wolf, again, head of the business for Ford's autonomous vehicle fleet. Again, there are driverless cars, Ford driverless cars right now in Miami. They are testing the streets here as they are building that fleet. Brian, it's been such a pleasure, man. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And he was joining us again from the studios of WDET in Detroit. All right, don't go anywhere because still to come, we're going to go back to live from the 305. This week's band calls their music post-nuclear rock. We're going to meet Electric Kiff coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the Miami-based band, jazz and rock improvisational band, I should say, Electric Kiff, is part of our Live from the 305. They are Eric Escanes, Rodrigo Zambrano, Jason Matthews, and Armando Lopez. They come to Miami from all over the country and globe, except for native Armando Lopez. Eric Escanes from France, Jason Matthews from Philadelphia, and Rodrigo Zambrano is from Mexico City. They will be playing next Saturday at the Moksha Art Collective in Wynwood as part of the Art Basel shows. Now, we spoke to them for today's episode of the Live from the 305, and they described their musical influences, Miami scene, and why they call their sound post-nuclear. And I started the conversation with bassist Rodrigo Zambrano. So what were your influences? What was a lot of the music that you were listening to as growing up as a kid?
Oh, well, there was only books in my house. And then I started asking for music. So my dad had like Miles Davis kind of blue, had the Beatles. He had like some like the John Coltrane ballads. So that was the first thing I heard. And then everything like reggae, jazz, rock.
What about Latin influences? What were some of the Latin influences that you had growing up?
Buena Vista when I was growing up. I love rock, like Argentinian rock and, you know, old school, like Soda Stereo and Spinetta and all that stuff. Latin rock was like Latin, not a lot of the Latin until I got to Miami. I got more into the jazz, Caribbean, all the Latin jazz stuff.
Does any of that come through in your playing now? Does any of that
A little bit, yeah. I enjoy it. I'm adding a little Latin here and there is always good.
All right. And Jason, let's see. You came to Miami from Philadelphia, which has a long history of jazz and R&B. What did you grow up on?
Yeah, I grew up on jazz pretty much in high school. But before that, I was obsessed with prog rock. So me and my brother were obsessed with this band called Yes, which you guys probably know for sure. Pink Floyd, Yes. ELP, and I was really into that. And then I started going into the jazz clubs in Philadelphia. Like, there's this place called Time and Chris's Jazz Cafe and Ortlieb's, and we would go and do the jam sessions every Tuesday. And that's how I got into jazz, which led me to University of Miami.
By the way, how old were you when you were going into those clubs?
15, 16.
Yeah?
Sneaking. Yeah, they wouldn't let us. They had like a late night Tuesday jam, and they wouldn't. You know, the guy was cool with us. He knew we were young kids just trying to jam. So, and no one was there at late night. It was just us pretty much watching, like, the older dudes play. And you would have to go and buy a drink and we could would just buy a Coke or whatever. You know,
you know what? I was thinking about. I mean, Miami obviously is this very international city, obviously, and you know, you think about the huge influence—not just Latin American, Caribbean, but really like from a lot of different places. It's coming from everywhere, and so I wanted to get the sense of how do you see Electric Kiff and your music as a reflection of what's going on in Miami? Or are you trying to break out of that and do something totally different? I want to hear from everybody on this.
Well, yeah, I think it's a total reflection of Miami in the sense that it's a melting pot and that, you know, and none of this was planned. It's not like, you know, we just kind of came together through certain circumstances. But what I think what we're trying to do is showcase that as this band, like when we go and tour in other places, say like, yo, Miami's got an awesome music scene underground too, and we represent it, you know. So I think that's one of the things that we do with the music, and the other thing is that we're just trying to write stuff that, you know, inspires people and keep playing and trying to make it work, really. So
Armando, what about you? How is it a reflection of what you're seeing? I want to get to also this underground scene. What is the scene?
Well, okay, so a couple things. Like, there's definitely an underground scene that's been building, and kind of what I mentioned before, like, I'm not sure if it existed, like, maybe 5 or 8, 10 years ago.
I think so.
But it's definitely grown into something different, at least musically. There's a lot of, like, new and young groups that are doing kind of different music, and, like, really different enough to stand out, you know? And I see it every time people come from out of town and they visit Miami. And apparently Miami has a bad reputation for music, the music scene, apparently. So these people come with no expectations. And every time they're like, oh, man, there's just some seriously killer bands or killer musicians, which there totally are.
Why is that? Why does Miami have a bad rep? For what?
It could be a couple of things. I mean, there has been, many years where there's not many available venues to play at and things like that.
Jason.
Well, I don't know. What do you think?
It's always been a, you know, party city, right? So people associate partying with, you know,
DJs
and club music and
all
that
stuff. A lot of Latin music, especially pop.
And even younger people that have never been to Miami just think, oh,
South
Miami's
Beach,
like, there's,
you know?
Ultra Festival. People know about that. And they know certain, you know, oh, it's just all electronic music, which I'm not. I love electronic
think
music.
Miami's South Beach, pretty much.
Yeah, South Beach.
So
right.
It's clubs and it's like Latin pop. And when you actually come here, it's pretty cool. You have Wynwood and all these artsy parts. And
so, Rodrigo, I mean, tell me, is it that musicians just don't think of Miami as a place they'd want to come to try to build up? I mean, go back. You go back to like the 50s and 60s. I mean, you talk about Jimi Hendrix was here.
You got people coming here. What's... Jack was from Fort Lauderdale.
Okay, yeah. What is it?
A lot of musicians were coming down here too and playing in the 80s.
For touring bands, it's hard to come all the way down to Florida.
That's the other thing. Because
it's like a 10-hour drive from Georgia, right? So,
okay.
So they just do like touring bands on a van, you know? Like famous people, yeah, Radiohead plays here. And, you know, I've seen D'Angelo.
So the touring is difficult. It's not enough.
Like the driving one.
Right, the driving tours.
Yeah, but for bands like lower on like on a lower level than Radiohead and all that stuff, it's hard to get down here for like, you know.
Right.
And
logistically,
so
you know.
Also, and Eric, let me ask you this too. I'm wondering, is it also venues? Is it just that we have a reputation and people just kind of brush us off? Or I mean, we've had big names, but obviously, as you said, they're pop names. I mean,
right.
You know, the Pitbulls and the Gloria Estefans, but I mean, you know, compared to like other cities, Seattle or LA or Chicago, I mean, where does Miami sit? Where do we sit on all this?
Low.
Wow.
No, I just think that like a lot of people in Miami don't want to pay to see live music, like pay tickets.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, you know,
when I take this one,
but Eric, I'm gonna keep hearing.
Like you said, mid-sized venues, it's hard to get people to pay for tickets to see live music, you know, compared to mm-hmm. other cities that we've played all on the Northeast. Because people mostly like they always think like it's included with the mm-hmm. experience in a place that you go, you know.
I'm talking with the Miami band, jazz and rock improvisational band, Electric Kiff. They are Eric Escanes, Rodrigo Zambrano, Jason Matthews, and Armando Lopez. They come to Miami from all over the world, actually, except, of course, for native Armando. They're describing their musical influences and how they developed what they call post-nuclear music. All right. Guys, who's going to describe to me what is post-nuclear?
Armando.
Okay.
honestly, I don't exactly remember how that came up. I think we were watching a Jim Carrey stand-up.
Yeah, yes. No.
Exactly right? Is it? Is it? Yeah.
We were watching the Jim Carrey Saturday Night Live.
That's right. He does Elvis. A post-nuclear Elvis where he's
Saturday
dancing.
Saturday Night Live audition. By
people like post-nuclear Elvis. Was ready to get ready. I'll go, okay, go. Now, don't you?
He's dancing like Elvis without arms, and we found it hilarious, and we're like, our music is like post-nuclear. I don't know, honestly, we write a lot of dark stuff. It sounds like the world is ending, so it kind of fit in there. As you heard today, the world's ended at 1 o'clock today.
I mean, when you go places, and you ever tell people that's what it's called,
yeah.
And they ask you, how do you describe, do you tell them the whole Jim Carrey thing?
This is the first time.
That was just for you, man.
Oh.
It's our way of deflecting saying, like...
We don't like tags, you know, like funk or jazz or
fusion.
You hate saying
fusion. Might be a little bit. I hate it. Yeah.
You've had the opportunity to play with a number of different musicians. You played with Brooklyn's jazz improv star, Snarky Puppy. You've played with Flo Rida. When you get the chance to work with these guys... Does any of that influence then come along into your music, or is it you're just doing that? But I'm just wondering if you get anything from it, if that influences future stuff.
Yeah, when we share the stage with these musicians, there's always some kind of like inspiration after seeing like really great bands like those. So there's always something to take home.
I'm just curious because you guys also, you also work with other musicians. You guys all break off and do different things. But I'm curious as to, when you're shifting around doing stuff for this group compared to what you're doing, touring with other groups. I wanted to get a sense of where's the focus? Is it towards touring live acts? What's the impetus, for, this group and especially for this last album that you guys had, Heist?
I'd say maybe there's two driving forces, which touring is definitely one. We want to play in front of people outside of Miami. That's, I mean, for sure, number one. And I would say 1B is to continue to write new music because, like, relatively we're a pretty new band, especially musically. So we have a lot of, like, growing to do musically. And every time we write something new, it's like a whole new thing for us.
And you heard from Eric Escanes, Rodrigo Zambrano, Jason Matthews, and Armando Lopez. They make up the band Electric Kiff. They will be playing next Saturday at the Moksha Art Collective in Wynwood as part of Art Basel. And listen, if you're on Twitter, go find us at WLRN Sundial. We got a video up there of their performance here at our studios, and it's really fascinating. We're going to have, by the way, a full list of their upcoming performances on our website, WLRN.org. And you can check out more about the group and see their in-studio performances, I said, at 3:05 today on our Facebook page at WLRN Sundial. They are a fun bunch. All right, still to come, we're going to look at a Battle of the Bands competition here in South Florida. It's known as The Flex. That's next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Have you ever heard about the Battle of the Bands music competition? South Florida has a very similar one, but this one is all about flexing your talents. If you're unfamiliar with the word flex, it means showing off or wearing your talent with pride. And that's what these musicians will be doing in front of an audience and a 3-judge panel. The winner of the competition will take home a recording studio session and music video shoot. We talked with the founder and president of The Flex, Khalil Bohannon, and I asked him why he decided to create this type of music competition.
I used to be the house drummer for an open mic known as The Imperial up in North Miami. And at the time, I was a student at FIU. So basically, I had to drive like 30, 40 minutes to dive into the culture and meet people, the network and stuff. And I just, with the little amount of gas that I had in my car, I didn't think that was okay. So I was like, I need something in my backyard. The Imperial actually ended up shutting down like 2-3 months after I joined it. So I was just like, all right, I might as well start my own thing. And I started up as an open mic and then eventually it segued into a music competition.
Yeah. Is it like a battle of the bands or how would you describe it?
Well, yeah, essentially just not everybody's a band. Like it's open to artists of all types and genres, rappers, singers, music duos, bands, you know, try and have everybody. It's kind of even playing ground.
How is it set up? For anybody who's never been, how do you set it up?
The Flex is it's divvied out into seasons, right? And in each season, there's going to be three preliminary rounds and one championship round. So in those three preliminary rounds, we'll have anywhere from six to eight artists come up on the stage, and we'll pick finalists to move on to the championship round. So put like three out of those six to eight. So we're picking like three artists out of three shows. So by the time you get to the championship, you have nine artists that came back and they're competing again. So by the time they come back to the championship, like they're hungry, like they want it. You know what I'm saying? So it's just a lot of energy, and it's really cool to see. Basically, yeah, three preliminary shows, one championship. And if you win twice, including the championship, that's when you're the champion and you get all the prizes associated with the Flex, the bragging rights. Yes.
Let's talk about the prizes besides bragging rights.
Yeah. So the first season, the prize was a recording session at this studio up in North Miami. It's called Audio Vision, world-class recording studio. I used to intern there, and that's why they hooked it up for me. The artist won a free recording session and distribution of that song on all platforms, Apple Music, Spotify, Tidal. And the second season, the artist won a music video shoot. So right now we're about to embark on the third season, and the prize for the third season is going to be a music video again, a recording session at my home studio, and also a podcast interview.
You know, real quickly, how are the winners chosen? How do you do that?
We have a panel of three judges, you know, and the judges are interchangeable, but two of the judges are always going to be previous champions from the other seasons of the Flex. Also other producers from around the city and event organizers and stuff. So it's kind of interchangeable, but each show is always only going to have three judges, and they're given a score sheet. And they score based off originality, creativity, stage presence, and crowd reaction.
So it's interesting you're talking about these prizes, and I'm wondering, like, are these opportunities to, you know, for studio time or to create videos, to get exposure? I mean, are those available right now here in Miami and South Florida, or is it difficult for artists to get those chances?
It's not difficult. You just have to really put yourself out there and network. Like I said, the recording studio session, I only got that because I was interning at that studio at the time, and they saw what I was doing. They were willing to lend me a helping hand. The music video, I had to pay a pretty penny for, but that was money that we had raised throughout the season, and I still got it at a discounted price because I was cool with the videographer, and again, he saw the vision, he was fond of it, so he's willing to work with me.
Is South Florida a good place to try to launch yourself, or do you have to go to New York or LA or some other place?
I wish I had a better answer for that because I only have experience operating in Miami. But I've heard multiple big-time artists. This rapper named Denzel Curry, he's pretty popular, kind of underground, but a lot of people that listen to rap know him. He went on some radio interview, and he, like, basically cursed out Miami for not being supportive enough because he's a Miami native, and he makes music here all the time. And he felt that he got more traction after he left and went to California, like New York and places like that. He felt like people were more supportive out there. So maybe had I started the Flex in a different area, I could have a more concrete answer. I could tell working in Miami hasn't been the easiest because I've had people that lie and don't do what they say they're going to do, or like they just don't commit. But it's not impossible. Like if you work hard, you can make anything happen anywhere.
You're a musician, right?
Yeah.
What do you do?
I play the drums. I've been playing the drums since I was 9 years old. I play a little bit of piano. Just enough to make you go like, oh, that's nice. And then I could play a couple chords on guitar, nothing crazy.
Why did you decide to go on the more on the business side of the industry than the performance?
My parents, they always supported me being a musician, but they were always like, there's not a whole lot of money in that field, you know, be careful. And even playing drums, I always knew I wanted to know a little bit more because, you know, instruments are cool, but money is a huge factor in life. Can't get around it. And business is the way to the money. Like, artists don't make money in the industry. You know what I'm saying? Even the top artists, they make 20% of their actual worth, you know? So it's better to at least know how that side works to give yourself a little bit of leverage.
This whole project is part of this Find Your Flex movement. What is that?
I named the event The Flex, I think, like three shows in, like while it was still the open mic. Because flexing is like wearing your talent with pride. Whatever you bring to the table or whatever you're passionate about, if you do it and it's known, that's your flex. And for me, music has always been my flex. And I feel like a lot of people find comfort and, you know, self-value in music. So I feel like my stage should be used as a way for other people to flex and make members in the crowd feel comfortable, just to show the average person that, yo, I could do whatever that person up on stage is doing. That's their flex. How can I find my flex? This season, we're going to start having the crowd get more involved. We're up on stage like, find your flex, you know, like a call and response kind of a thing, just to make people feel like they're a part of the event and not just they were like there watching it.
I like that idea, wearing your talent with pride. Mm-hmm. That's pretty good. I like that. What do you tell your friends about, you know, or you know, family, friends, or anybody about, you know, what you're trying to accomplish with this project if they've never been?
I mean, on the surface level, it's just a music competition, you know? But I feel like at the same time, there's a lot of talent that Miami has to offer that people don't get to see. So I'm trying to, like, bring them into the limelight. Because if you're a champion for the Flex, that means you beat a lot of other people to get to the top. And I feel like your music deserves to be heard. So that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to have people that are really hungry in the game that show that they want it. And I want to give them that platform that they deserve.
I do like that idea. Show your flex. I wonder if that's what I'm doing here every time I open up the microphone. He'll probably tell me I'm wrong. That was Khalil Bohannon. He is the founder and president of The Flex. It's a competition for musicians in South Florida to showcase their talent in front of an audience and a 3-judge panel. Now, the winner, again, takes home a recording studio session and a music video shoot. And the upcoming Flex competition is this Sunday, December 2nd, at the Open Stage Club in Coral Gables. The doors open at 8 o'clock. And if you're interested in participating, you can find out more information on our Facebook and Twitter pages. Just look us up at WLRN Sundial. Hey, did you get to hear our interview yesterday with Silas House for the Sundial Book Club? He was joining us from the studios of Key West. He's really cool. His book, Southernmost, was the title for our November Sundial Book Club. If you haven't read it, I'm highly recommending it. Please check it out. And we've got a special that's coming up next Tuesday. Of course, we're going to be in December, so we're going to have a special announcement for our Sundial Book Club theme for December. That's coming up again next Tuesday. And if you're not part of our book club, find us on Facebook. Find our Facebook group, the Sundial Book Club, and please ask to join it, because we'd love to have you. We'd love to hear about your thoughts on the books that we're reading. We'd love to hear about what you're reading and what kind of books you want to read in the coming months. By the way, you're listening to Electric Kiff right now. That was the band for our Live from the 305 this week. Again, they are performing in Wynwood next Saturday as part of Art Basel. We will have full details about all of their upcoming concerts. Coming up next, you're going to hear the R&B band Soul Packs, also from Miami. We'll be highlighting South Florida musicians through the series over the coming months. And again, that's part of our Live from the 305 series. Well, that is Sundial for this Thursday, November 29th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a great Friday. Have a great weekend. Talk to you on Monday.